from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Rich, poor, or struggling middle, soaring American inequality is drawing everyone's attention these days. It is changing the texture of life in this country, changing our politics, changing the feel of our economy. Last week, we had conservative economist Tyler Cowen on this show, talking it through with Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz. Today, liberal former U.S. Labor Secretary Robert Reich is with us, and more. He's got a big new film out this hour, On Point, Robert Reich and Inequality for All. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. How do you look at our soaring inequality? Do you see it, like Robert Reich, bad for the economy, bad for democracy, or not? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Hear from the new film, opens this Friday, Inequality for All, Robert Reich introducing himself to a class at UC Berkeley.
My name is Robert Reich. I was Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton. Before that, I was at Harvard. Before that, I was in the Carter administration. Do you remember? You don't remember the Carter administration. Before that, I was a special aide to Abraham Lincoln. Those were tough times.
Robert Reich talking to young Americans in the new film Inequality for All. That's the fun stuff. Here's a clip from the movie of him out on the hoof speaking to Occupy protesters in 2011, saying rising inequality represents a fundamental threat to American democracy. From the film.
We are losing equal opportunity in America. We are losing the moral foundation stone on which this country and our democracy are built. It undermines our democracy when all that money can come down from the wealthy, from the corporations, when there are no limits to the amount of money that can infect and undermine and corrupt our democracy. Then what do we have left?
From the new film, Inequality for All. Later in this hour, we'll have some conservative analysis from a colleague of economist Tyler Cowen. But first, joining us from New York is Robert Reich, political economist, professor of public policy at UC Berkeley, Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton, star and subject of the new documentary, Inequality for All, directed by Jacob Kornbluth. It won the Documentary Special Jury Prize at Sundance and opens across the country on Friday. You can see a trailer for the film at our website, onpointradio.org. Robert Reich, now film star. Welcome back to On Point. It's always good to have
not
you.
Not quite a film star. Hi, Tom.
How are you? A little bit. Al Gore had his Inconvenient Truth, and this is very much along those lines. Why on film? We've seen you on the hoof. We've seen you all over on television. You've always been at the, you've long been at the university podium. Why the film, Bob?
Well, listen, I've tried everything else. I've run out of options. I mean, you know, my books are the kind of books that once you put them down, you can't pick them up. It seems to me, quite seriously, Tom, that the issue of widening inequality of income and wealth and political power has got completely out of control. I mean, I've talked about this for 30 years on and off. I've written about it. I've tried to do something about it as Secretary of Labor and in other administrations. But nothing has changed. In fact, the situation is far worse. 95% of all of the economic gains since the recession ended, since the recovery began in 2009, 95% of the economic gains have gone to the top 1%. The median household is actually worse off, adjusted for inflation today, than the median household was in 2009. We can't go on this way.
Let me ask you, just to sort of get this out on the table, just to get started here. Robert Reich, do you have a problem with capitalism? Do you have a problem with wealth?
Oh, heavens no. Look, capitalism is the only system that actually has been shown to generate prosperity and the only system around the world that works. I mean, even China is becoming capitalist. The issue is not the isms, Tom. It's not capitalism versus socialism versus communism versus fascism. The real issue here is how to save capitalism from its own excesses. We've done it before in this country. We did it in the progressive era between 1901 and 1909. We did it again in the 1930s, between 1933 and 1939. We did it to a large extent in the 1960s, between 1963, 1968, a little bit in the 1990s, I would like to think, under Bill Clinton. Mm. So we are reformers at heart. When we understand the nature of a problem in this country, we roll up our sleeves and we put ideology aside and we get on with what has to be done. I think my real concern is that there is so much misinformation, so much disinformation, so much ideological claptrap around this issue that people don't know what's happening. They don't know what has to be fixed. There's so much blame game. And that's really why we did the film.
Let's go to core information then, in your view, or just, you know, from the numbers, Robert Reich, core information that you want people to know, to understand. Perspectives on it can be different, and we'll hear some of that in this hour. But what's the core information set that's driving your passion here?
Well, the basic reality is that we're now more unequal in terms of income and wealth and political power. And opportunity. They all go together. We're more unequal than we've been certainly in 80 years, according to the data, and arguably in more than a century. And that is bad for the economy. We can talk fairness. We all have different views of what is fair. We have all different views of how much inequality is tolerable. But it's bad for the economy because when the middle class, the vast middle class and the poor don't have enough purchasing power, when almost all of the economic gains go to a small group at the top, then they can't, that is the middle class and the poor, can't turn around and buy what the economy can produce at or near full employment, which means you're going to have a very, very fragile economy. This recovery that we're in, some people say, what recovery? Well, it's a very slow, fragile, remarkably anemic recovery. And one of the reasons is that people just don't have the purchasing power, most people. And the rich, they don't spend all of their income. They save it, and their savings go around the world to where it can get the highest return. And we saw this same pattern leading up to the last time we had this degree of inequality, which was 1928. And we know what happened in 1929. When your vast numbers of people just don't have the purchasing power and they borrow and they go into debt, then you get debt bubbles. When so much income and wealth is at the top, you've got boom and busts because you've got a lot of speculation going on. And we have seen that. That's what led us to 2008, and we're still in trouble. So, Tom, argument number one is it's bad for the economy. The rich would do better with a smaller share of a rapidly growing economy than they would right now with a large share of an economy that's barely growing at all. Argument number two is that it's bad for our democracy. As the great jurist, Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis said in the late 19th century when inequality was getting out of control, he said, look, we can either have a democracy or we can have great wealth in the hands of a very few people, but we can't have both. Because what happens inevitably in our society, in any capitalist democracy, is that when you have huge amounts of concentrated income and wealth at the top, political power migrates there as well. And we've seen that. We're seeing it right now. I mean, the bankrolling of various groups, the huge, huge amounts that billionaires contributed to the last election and are still contributing and distorting and undermining our politics, particularly after that absurd Supreme Court decision, one of the worst in history, Citizens United against the Federal Election Commission. Well, we can't go on this way. If we want our economy and our democracy to function for all of us as our economy and democracy must, if we want to avoid the cynicism, the anger, the frustration that so many Americans right now feel, we've got to reform capitalism.
Why is this happening now, Robert Reich? You look back to 1973. That was a kind of near the end of the long period of great American equality, the post-war boom and all that. The top 1%, their share of income, bottomed out in 1973. These are the latest figures at 7.7%. Top 1% took home 7.7%. The top 1% takes home more than 19, almost 20% of the country's household income. Recoveries, you know, we had a recovery in the 90s, and 45% of the comeback went to the top 1%. The next recovery, 65% went to the top 1%. And this recovery, as you say, 95% of income gains going to the top 1%. Why this trend?
Well, there are two underlying forces here, and they started to affect the entire structure of the economy in the late 1970s. One is globalization. Frankly, we're now in a global capital market, a global product market, a global service market. Big American corporations have gone global, and that is a challenge in terms of maintaining high incomes, particularly if we don't have an educational system and an infrastructure and public investments that enable a lot of Americans to be as competitive individually as we need to be. And secondly, you've got technological changes that have displaced a lot of workers, particularly in the mid-range of our workforce. I mean, we're getting manufacturing back in the United States, but look at those manufacturing jobs. There are not many coming back. Those manufacturing facilities that are now coming back to the United States don't have the big assembly lines. They have robots. They have numerically controlled machine tools. So those are the two forces, Tom, but that is not the end of the discussion, because other countries have done a much better job ameliorating, reducing the effects of those forces and providing much more widespread prosperity and equal opportunity.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American inequality through the lens of former U.S. Labor Secretary Robert Reich. He's star and subject of a new film on the issue out this week. It's called Inequality for All. Here's a little bit from the film. They're interviewing Nick Hanauer here, a multimillionaire pillow company CEO. He talks in the film Inequality for All about how income inequality can be damaging to the U.S. economy.
The problem with rising inequality is a person like me who earns 1,000 times as much as the typical American doesn't buy 1,000 pillows a year. Even the richest people only sleep on one or two pillows.
The pillow business is quite tough, as it is for many, many industries, because fewer and fewer people can afford to buy the products that we make.
It's not just lines on an economist's chart. It's an economic problem, Robert Reich says. Here's a clip from the trailer of the new documentary, Inequality for All.
Of all developed nations, the United States has the most unequal distribution of income, and we're surging toward even greater inequality. 1928 and 2007 become the peak years for income concentration. It looks like a suspension bridge.
Last year, we made $36,000.
I probably make $50,000 a year, working 70 hours a week.
The middle class is struggling.
Robert Reich, he's got a point to make. He makes it in Inequality for All. There's been pushback to Robert Reich for years on this point here on the O'Reilly Factor last year. Bill O'Reilly speaking to Lou Dobbs, calling Robert Reich a communist.
Robert Reich, you know Robert Reich?
I do indeed.
He's a communist, you know that, right?
Communist slash socialist.
Okay.
He's a guy
he secretly adores Karl Marx.
Really? Just for caring about, the deepest inequality in a century? Bob, last week we had Tyler Cowen on. He's a smart economist. He's looked a lot at this. He's got a new book out called Average is Over. And in that he says, essentially, look, this is what's coming. There's more of this coming. And if you're smart and ambitious, here's your way out of it. And if you don't get on the sort of track that will put you in the upper tier, it's just going to be tough, and we don't have the resources as a nation to change it. So this is where we're headed, folks. Just put your seatbelt on.
Well, I hope he's wrong, because the seatbelt is not going to keep us all very safe. I mean, we're headed for a real crack-up in terms of the economy and our democracy. It seems to me we've got to do a lot. In the film, Tom, we don't get didactic, and we don't make a political point of it. I mean, the thing that I'm intent on doing is what I do in my classes, and that is enabling people to see much more subtly and deeply what's going on, understand why it's a problem, and the solutions flow from an understanding of the problem. You said as you were closing that this is sort of an inconvenient truth for the economy. And, I admire Al Gore enormously, but I must say I am funnier than Al Gore.
There's some truth to that.
Yes, it's a low bar.
Not a
it is a low
guy.
Bar.
That's true.
But, the movie is entertaining. I mean, people who have seen it in screenings we've done have come up to me and said, I've laughed and I've cried, and this has really hit me. And that's, I think, the way to understanding. You know, people learn not just through their brains but through their hearts. And wonderful director, a young director, Jake Kornbluth, I think a genius. You know, he came to me 2 years ago with this idea, and I was skeptical, but he did it. He deserves the credit.
Why are you out there doing it with the film? He was pushing it. You had to agree. Al Gore did An Inconvenient Truth. It got a lot of attention. He ended up with a Nobel Prize, but here we are still on the climate front with so many things unsolved. I mean, do you think film is still a medium that moves people? What do you think Al Gore thinks about that these days?
Well, I don't know what Al Gore thinks. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to win a Nobel Prize. But, you know, I have two sons who are in their 20s, and I have a granddaughter, and they've convinced me, and of course I teach people in their 20s, they all respond to film and video in a much more powerful and a visceral way than I ever did, and my generation does. And I think that this is a problem that's not going to be solved immediately. There's no magic bullet. But the young people today, they've got to understand it. They're inheriting it. They've got to change this, or their generation is going to have a lot to do with solving this. If it's ever going to be solved, they're going to pay a huge price. In fact, arguably, they're already paying a great price. So movie is a way of reaching them, reaching people.
We'll look at some of the solutions that Robert Reich puts forward in the new film, Inequality for All. Let's go first to Tina in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Tina, you're on the air.
Yes. I just wanted to say that I think we've just stopped caring about each other in this country. You know, it's all yay for me and too bad for you. And until we start really caring about our neighbors and about, you know, what's happening to the poorest of the poor in this country and to the middle class, you know, and I live in the state of Wisconsin where we've just had so much turmoil, you know, lately. And you know, it's all about how much money these corporations are going to pay our politicians to get reelected. And it's not anything about us. It doesn't matter who we vote for anymore. I feel like I'm just frustrated. Every day I wake up, I hear the news or I watch a documentary, and every day I just feel less and less a part of this country. And, you know, it's just, I don't know where it stops. I don't know where the solution comes from. But eventually, people in our country are just, we have to start caring about each other and stop arguing with each other. And maybe we can get something done.
Tina, I'll put that to Bob Reich, and I appreciate your call right there. I think a lot of people understand that sense of what's going on. Ryan in Charleston, South Carolina. Ryan, you're on.
Yes, I got a comment and a question. First thing, my wife, she's worked for Kohl's now for 7 years, and she only makes a little over $10 an hour, and it's really frustrating for me to see them pay her what she gets paid for the stress and the work that she does. Mm-hmm. But my question is, what are we supposed to do about it, the people at the bottom or the middle class? Obviously, the money's at the top, so that's where the policymakers are, that's where the lobbyists are. What can somebody in the middle class do besides write their congressman or senator?
Ryan, I appreciate your call as well. Bob Reich, in a way, the same question from Tina and Ryan. You know, they see the problem, experience, describing it in different ways there, but what do you do when you're making $10 an hour at Kohl's, and that's a pretty full-time job?
Well, the one of the intents of the movie, Tom, is to give people a sense of efficacy. I mean, they can do things about this. And we're not alone. I mean, each of us, if we work with other people, can make this economy work for all of us and can turn politics around. It's not going to happen in Washington. Washington is not a leading indicator. It's a lagging indicator. You can have the best people in Washington. It doesn't matter. They're not going to be doing what the public needs. They're going to be responding to the moneyed interests unless people out there in the country are organized and mobilized and energized to change all of this. And so I say to Tina, you're absolutely right. We've got to care about each other. We've got to get out of this shouting match. You know, Bill O'Reilly calls me a communist last night on his show. He got very angry that I was even raising the fact that he called me a communist. You know, he won't even have me on the show. He will not debate me. He will not even discuss this kind of poisonous vitriol that he and others are putting into our system with all the name-calling. And Ryan, the only way we start raising the minimum wage, making it possible for middle-class, lower-middle-class people to have the kind of living standard and status that the middle class and those aspiring to join the middle class had 20 or 30 years ago, relative to everybody else, particularly those at the top. The only way to do that is to change the rules of the game, and they can be changed. They must be changed. At the end of the movie, we have a website, and we talk about major things that individuals can do. They can, you know, citizenship, Tom, is more than just voting and serving on juries and paying taxes. Citizenship is taking an active, engaged role in what is happening in this country and avoiding cynicism.
Easy to say. After 7 years at $10 an hour, you might feel cynical. What are the rule changes that you'd like to see that you think might be effective in changing or the direction of inequality, its steep climb?
Well, my own list. I mean, this is just for me, and I don't preach this in the movie, and I don't preach it in my classes. But first, I do think the minimum wage does need to be raised. If we had the same minimum wage we had in 1968, adjusted for inflation, it would be way over $10 an hour. And if you add in productivity improvements since then, it would probably be up to $14 or $15 an hour. And then increase and widen the earned income tax credit, something that most people don't even know about. It's a wage subsidy. We've got to
for the poor,
tax reform.
Mm-hmm.
I would exempt the first $15,000 of income from Social Security taxes and take the cap off of the percentage of income that is now subject to Social Security, which is now, I think the cap is about $110,600 when I last looked. Mm-hmm. Financial reform, bring back Glass-Steagall and cap the size of the big banks so that we don't have another financial crisis that really took a huge toll on the middle class and the poor, but not on the wealthy. I mean, as we just talked about, since the recovery began, the top 1%, many of them on Wall Street, many of them hedge fund and private equity managers, they've got 95% of all the benefits since the recovery. I would, unionize low-wage workers. You know, Walmart, McDonald's, I mean, these people are not teenagers anymore. They do need a union. They are adults. Many of them are primary breadwinners for their households. And I'd get money, big money, out of politics, Tom. Easy to say. But, you know, for many years, with the Watergate reforms starting in 1974, we did have public financing of major elections. And until the Supreme Court just opened the floodgates with Citizens United, which we have to reverse by a constitutional amendment.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we've got to get big money out of politics. We could go on. We could talk about health care. My own personal view is we need to move to a single payer plan. I think that is inevitable. There's no way else to do it and to really keep costs under control. But my views may be different from a lot of your listeners, and that's fine. We just got to roll up our sleeves and get to work and stop yelling at each other and stop this kind of gridlock and paralysis and cynicism that has gripped the country.
This show has a long dialogue that's gone on this. We've talked with you about it before. Again, we talked to Tyler Cowen just last week, The Economist. I mean, his view was that in the mid-20th century, we had a special time that made that American equality possible. We're not going back there. It's just not going to be the same. Government does not have the resources to change it, and the accommodations are going to come in many ways in people's lives. I mean, he's describing lots of college-educated Americans in the not very distant future, living lives of economic fragility. And that's just the way it's going to be.
That's ridiculous.
We'll look
Tom.
More like Texas. People will live in simpler houses. I mean, he didn't say adobe huts, but he spoke kind of admiringly of how people are happy in low-income Mexico. We could be too. That this is sort of where we're going.
Well, I think that kind of economic fatalism is just simply wrong. If we allow the current trends to continue, with a larger and larger percentage of national income and wealth going to a smaller and smaller group of people, then we don't have a society. We don't have a democracy. And we don't have an economy that works. You know, in those years, from 1946 to 1977 or 78, when prosperity was very widely shared, the economy grew faster than it has grown since. And remember, in those years, we had a top marginal tax rate on the very wealthy that was never below 70%. And even when you consider the tax credits and all of the tax deductions, the top earners were still paying over 50% of their marginal taxes, in taxes. And the economy did very well. I mean, under Dwight Eisenhower, a Republican, nobody considered him a socialist. The top marginal tax rate was 91%, and nobody complained. For Tyler Cowen or for anybody to say it's just inevitable where we are right now is just plain silly. We invested in those years in higher education. We had a GI Bill. We had the largest and most ambitious highway building program in American history, created the entire interstate highway system under Dwight Eisenhower. We expanded civil rights and voting rights. We created Medicare and Medicaid. We did not feel that anything was inevitable. We felt that the economy was not something out there that we just had to accept. We understood that the economy is a set of rules, and the rules can be changed, and those rules can be changed so that there is much wider and broader prosperity. And we've got to get back to that.
Yeah, of course, the economy was pretty good to us in those years. Steve in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air with Bob Reich.
Tom, I certainly acknowledge that there's some terrible economic disparities in this country. But as a conservative, I'm very loath to hand over to Professor Reich the kinds of political power he is demanding or asking for in terms of completely reorganizing our economy. I mean, we can always make things worse, and in many countries they have made things worse by just doing that. And the next point and the last point is that we can't expect to have the kind of prosperity we had in the 50s and 60s when we were the only functioning economic power in the world. I mean, that's not inevitable. It's unrealistic to expect that kind of wealth again.
Do we have to be fatalists then, Steve? Like whatever comes?
No, Tom, we don't have to be fatalists, but we can't all have McMansions. We can't all have two cars. We can't have flat-screen TVs in every room.
How about just a strong middle class? Can we reasonably aspire to that for this country, Steve?
Well, I certainly think we can aspire to something better than what we have. I agree with Professor Reich on that point.
Thank you, Steve. Bob Reich, we can't go back, and he doesn't want to hand over, reform power to maybe you or anybody else.
Well, Steve doesn't have to hand over the politics to me. I mean, the politics right now are under the control of big corporations and very rich people. I mean, that's why, for example, private equity managers and hedge fund managers can still pay only 15% on their income because they have the political power to make sure that there are rules that in the tax code that treat their income as capital gains. I mean, the real choice here is not a so-called free market existing in a state of nature, or government. Government sets the rules, and if the rules are going to be set by anybody, it should not be just a small group of wealthy people and corporations that are going to entrench their own wealth and power through those rules. It ought to be a much more responsive democracy, and that's why we've got to get big money out of politics.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American inequality through the lens of former U.S. Labor Secretary Robert Reich. He is star and subject of a new film on the issue out this week. It's called Inequality for All. Joins us this hour from New York. We're going to hear in just a moment from economist Jason Fichtner. A little bit of our online response first for you, Bob Reich. Jonathan writes, Robert Reich would make a marvelous president. I know, too short, also too smart. Okay, there's some love for you. Here, Krieger says, the big inequality is access to influence government. The rich have pretty much exclusive access, a point you're making here. But then a couple of others. Nguyen says, the answer is to live the best life you can, to make yourself happy, not to compare your net worth with others. Bam, problem solved. And another listener writes, making the rich poorer will not make the poor richer. What do you say, Bob?
Well, first of all, there is absolutely, I don't think, any legitimate argument about making the rich poorer. I think the point is that this is not a zero-sum game in which the only way the middle class and the poor can do better is if the rich do worse. It's actually, potentially, it should be, it was for 30 years after the Second World War, a win-win game. In the sense that, as I said before, Tom, the rich would do much better with a smaller share of a rapidly growing economy than they're doing right now with a big share of an economy that is basically barely growing and a society that is at loggerheads. The other point that we should just be content and not compare
Take
ourselves.
Take care of yourself,
I think that there's something to that. This is not a plea or any kind of an argument for just buying more stuff and being more envious. No, the point of the film is that our economy itself and our democracy are both imperiled by the degree of inequality we are now experiencing. And also, we see a lot of dissension. Political scientists have studied this for years and found that there's a direct correlation between the extent and degree of inequality in a society and the divisiveness in a society, the polarization in that society. And I think it comes from the same source, which is that when you have more and more and more people who are frustrated and angry, they've been working harder and harder, they're not getting anywhere, well, that makes them very vulnerable to demagogues on the left or the right who want to blame scapegoats. We've seen this in history. And there's also right now there's a lot of scapegoating going on. I mean, people on the left blame the rich and corporations and people on the right blame the poor and government. Once you get into the blame game, once you get into scapegoating, that can easily be a slippery slope. If we don't turn this around, we could find ourselves in a very ugly place. I think that some people would say we're already there.
Bob Reich, Robert Reich, he is a star and subject of the big new film Inequality for All. Last week, in this hour, we talked with Tyler Cowe, an economist who's out with his book Average is Over. And we brought in, late in the hour, Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, who has a bit more liberal view, a more alarmed view about inequality than Tyler Cowen does. Robert Reich, if I may right now, I want to bring in a colleague of Tyler's to sort of sit and talk with us and you for a moment. Jason Fichtner joins us from Washington. He's a senior research fellow at George Mason University's Mercatus Center. Jason Fichtner, thank you very much for being with us today. It's great to have you here.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be back on your show. And hello, Bob. It's a pleasure to be on the show with you as well.
Hi, Jason.
Let's dive right in. Bob Reich says, you know, we've got a degree of inequality that is getting so high that it threatens our economy and our democracy. What about it, Jason? Does inequality, even at the levels we're hitting at, in your view, does it threaten our economy? Does it threaten our democracy?
I think Bob is onto something that both he and Tyler are actually in some ways in the same box, and that they recognize that the current environment we're in right now is limiting our ability to opportunity, and if we don't change something, we're going to have an unequal growth on the returns to that economy. I think where my difference comes with looking at Bob is he's trying to focus on how government can get more involved in redistributing the pie and changing the rules. I kind of want to step back and look at where is government involved now, where even if it's well-intentioned, the government involvement is probably making things harder for the middle class and the poor to get ahead and would actually be hurting them, including current things in our tax code like the mortgage interest deduction, which primarily benefits higher-end workers at the detriment of lower-end workers from owning a home.
But the general trend overall, you can cite exceptions, but the general trend in the years since inequality has increased has been less government involvement. We're not in the great society years anymore, and we haven't been in all this times. How do we, with less government involvement, I mean, you may be right, people are leery of that, but what we've seen, Jason, is higher and higher and higher inequality during that period. So what do we do?
Well, I think it's important to point out what do we mean by government involvement. So the government can get involved in being activists. They can go in and say, we're having new rules, we're having new regulations.
But we've gone the other way. We took out Glass-Steagall. We took out all kinds of rules about the financial world. Look what happened there.
But we also did things in our tax code which makes things more expensive for the middle class and poor. We've made housing more expensive. We've actually, even through student loan subsidization, have actually now made college tuition more expensive.
How so with housing, with tuition?
So here's this is to do with housing. So right now we have a deduction for those who own a home and pay a mortgage and have interest deduction. The only way to qualify for that deduction is if you actually have more interest to deduct than your standard deduction that you can get on your tax return. So we're basically incentivizing people to buy more expensive homes, larger homes, second homes, and vacation homes. We're not giving a benefit to those at the lower income level who could use a benefit like a tax credit instead of a deduction to buy a house at the margin. So we're penalizing those of the poor, and by incentivizing those like in my income bracket to buy bigger and more expensive homes, we're raising prices of homes across the board, making it harder for lower income people to buy and own a home.
So where's the solution? I mean, talking with Tyler Cowen last week, he's painting a picture where it's very hard to change this trend. His major advice in his book is for individuals. Here's how to line yourself up to do all right in this great era of inequality. And if you don't, then, well, you live a more bohemian lifestyle. You'll have economic fragility. You may move to Texas. You may have poor quality housing. But those are coping mechanisms. I don't see him talking so much about turning the inequality around. He seems to suggest it's just baked in our future, Jason.
Yeah, and sort of like Bob, I think Tyler makes me think a lot about where the future is going. And like Bob, I don't want to live in that future. I want to change it. And the question is, how do we do it so that we don't disincentivize innovation and property growth? We also don't leave people behind.
So what's the active step or steps that you suggest that if they're different from Bob Reich's?
So part of it is part with Bob. I'm with Bob on citizenship. I want people across the income spectrum to get more involved. And I also want to see investment. And this is the key word, not just government spending, but investment. I think Bob and I would agree we want to see people, we want to invest in education. But think about our current budget stalemate that's going on now in my town in Washington, D.C. Mm. We can't pass a budget. We have entitlements, whether it's Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Those costs are driving so much of the federal budget growth that it's crowding out our ability to invest in infrastructure and education, probably the two investments that Bob and I would agree we need more of. But we don't have the money to do it because we're spending it all on entitlements.
Robert Reich, not government programs, please, but investment. What do you say?
Well, I think Jason is exactly right. I would say more government investment in education, better government investment in education, in infrastructure. But I think the basic point here, and I don't know whether Jason agrees or disagrees with this point, is that the choice is not more or less government. The real question is how is government setting the rules of the game? Who is government working for and responsive to? And my concern is that as more and more wealth and income are concentrated at the top, the government is responsive less and less to the broad middle class and the poor, and more responsive to the demands through lobbyists and through campaign contributions of a very small elite, including very big corporations. And they are getting, you know, the dice are loaded in their favor. I mean, I couldn't agree more with Jason. For example, limit the mortgage interest deduction, because right now it's tilted in the direction of the wealthy. Why should somebody who is buying a gigantic mansion, why should they be able to deduct $200,000 or $300,000 of interest on that? I mean, that's perverse. But we get those perverse results because we've got so much political power at the top that are entrenching their benefits. The answer is to get that, you know, to get big money out of politics.
Jason, I want to get your response there. A couple of calls first, if I may. Marcia in Plainfield, Connecticut. Marcia, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I want to thank you for the opportunity to listen to a true American patriot, Robert Reich, and the excellent conversation where you've touched on, to me, the point I wanted to make, the egregious disparity of wealth in this country, which is really the symptom of our lack of tax equity or a tax system that should be in place so that the poor and the middle class can have benefits from our government that are at least equal to the benefits that the super wealthy get, because the super wealthy are really the ones that are benefiting from the tax code.
Marcia, we can see that benefit right now. I mean, it's just right there in the numbers we've been talking about all hour. But what do you say to conservative listeners who say, yeah, there's a problem, but if you do what you're talking about, you're going to disincent people from making the kind of effort needed for real economic growth?
Well, we, as Reich pointed out earlier, when we had a much higher marginal tax rate, there was no disincentive. In fact, there was greater growth. And I think that the political system, as you've said, has become so distorted that it's going to be very hard to change. But somehow the super wealthy that have all the political power, when you write your congressman as a little now.
Yeah, Marcia, you're breaking up, but I think you've got it. If you write him as a little person, as a minnow, you may not get the same hearing. You probably won't. We'll pick it up. Joel in Wadsworth, Ohio. Joel, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for the opportunity here.
Yes.
I really think that some of the points you touched on were really important to people my age. I'm in my mid-20s, and I see a lot of people, the millennials, as we're called, mm-hmm. who feel like income inequality is almost an unescapable hurdle for us,
mm-hmm.
that some of the past generations didn't have to tackle. And
that is true.
What do you feel is something that people my age can contribute is my question, because personally I feel like this is something that we're all in together, in the sense that without a strong middle class, we start to see more and more relying on social and governmental programs, and that does put people more at a whim to possible cuts to those programs and budgetary changes. So what do you think is the, I guess, the best thing that my generation could bring to this to try to work for?
I'll bring it to Bob Reich, who works a lot with young people, obviously, in his role as a college teacher. But Jason, first, if I may, let's look back to our earlier caller's question on tax and tax equity. And she says, come on, if you got this much income and wealth that's in this part of society, let's tap that to get those at the other end up and in gear and effectively participating in society and the economy. How about it, Jason?
Well, I think we already need to realize that right now we still have a very, very progressive tax system as it is. I mean, I just have numbers in front of me for the federal taxes. But right now, the top 10% are paying 70% of all federal income taxes. And those are people making about $110,000 a year and more, even if they're a married couple. So you go look at someone, say, to a teacher in New York and a cop in New York who are married, they're making $120 a year, and you're saying you're in the top 10%, you're rich, you've got to pay more. They're already paying enough. I think the biggest problem we're having, and this goes to the other caller as well about what mm-hmm. millennials can do, we really have a jobs crisis. And I don't mean the government should be supplying jobs, but we need to figure out how to create an environment in which there is more job creation, lowering the cost to wage barriers so people can actually work and businesses want to employ people. That actually increases then the pie, the economic pie that Bob and I are both worried about. More people working means they're paying more taxes. That actually supports the benefits we all want for society.
But we've heard that language for decades now, and still we see this trend line going toward greater and greater inequality. What's the problem with Jason?
Well, I think the problem is our federal budget, and I really, it's a complex problem. I don't want to oversimplify it, but if you look over the past 30 years, the share of the federal pie that has been going to the three largest entitlement programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, has dramatically increased, and that is crowding out our ability to fund other things. And it's causing this whole problem in Washington about discourse. Bob and I want to have discourse and academic conversations where we're polite with each other. You don't see politeness happening now in Capitol Hill. It's because they're fighting and fighting over a smaller and smaller share of the discretionary budget because so much of it is going towards mandatory spending. We can't then invest in education and infrastructure.
Robert Reich, entitlements, federal the tax burden sharing, and then millennials. You work among them, but take on the entitlement burden or obligation and tax sharing, burden sharing.
Well, obviously Medicare and Social Security are going to be under great strain because you've got a baby boom generation. I was born in 1946, and I'm an early boomer. Bill Clinton, Hillary Rodham Clinton in 1947, George W. Bush in 1946. Anybody who's anybody was born in 1946, Tom. You know that.
Okay, I'll take your word for it.
But as a result, so you got 76 million boomers from between 1946 and 1964. They're getting old. All their bodies are starting to corrode together. And healthcare has got to get under control. I mean, that's the real problem, with regard to Medicare and Social Security is the boomer generation plus rising healthcare costs. And we can't do much about the boomer generation. I mean, we can have a better ratio of young workers to boomers. And I think immigration is part of the answer there. But with regard to healthcare, I say again, I think we're going to have to move to a single payer system eventually in order to get those costs under control. But going
tax
back
burden
to the,
sharing, Jason says 10% already of Americans already pay 70% of federal taxes.
Well, that's not that. Look, we that doesn't include Social Security taxes, which 80% of Americans pay more in Social Security taxes than they do in income taxes. Let's look at all of the taxes. Let's not just look at income taxes. Look at sales taxes. You know, the middle class and the poor are burdened by sales taxes to a much greater extent than the rich because sales taxes are a regressive tax. If you took a look at all the taxes people pay, the actual burden on the middle class and the poor is proportionally much greater today relative to the rich than it was 20 or 30 years ago.
And speak to Joel, our young caller, who says, what can we millennials do? After all, they're going to live with this. This will be in the heart of their lives, this future.
Yeah. Joel, number one, see my movie. Number two, don't be cynical, because if we succumb to cynicism, that's the end of the game. Then we give up on everything. Then we can't do anything. It's self-perpetuating. Number three, organize, mobilize, and energize. You know, take politics back. Take it seriously. Be a citizen activist. That's the only way we're going to actually begin to turn this around.
Do you see your young students preparing to sort of accept this inequality or resist it, Bob?
Well, after they take my course, they resist it. One great thing about teaching, particularly young people, is that it just keeps me optimistic. This is a wonderful young generation. They are filled with idealism, filled with energy. They're not going to let this continue.
The movie is Inequality for All. Robert Reich, thank you. Jason Fichtner, thank you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.